Okay, I am with Adam Mosley, senior lecturer at Swansea University.
Hi.
And we're going to be talking today about history, what you got into history, and a bit about your research. To start off with, what got you into history?
That's a complicated story, which I'll try to simplify. When it came to choosing my A-levels, I was torn between the sciences and the humanities, and I ended up plumping for the sciences while doing the humanities a little bit on the side. So I actually took AS-level history with my A-levels. Went to university to become an organic chemist. Didn't enjoy it so much, but was very fortunate to be doing a degree where history and philosophy of science was part of the programme from the second year onwards. So I was able to take options in history and philosophy of science, and then in my third year I specialised in history and philosophy of science. So I think if I hadn't had that choice in my second year of my sciences degree, I might have ended up switching to history anyway. But that, I suppose, explains why I've ended up as a historian of science rather than of anything else.
So it was as much the fact that you didn't like chemistry and...
Well, I really missed... My first year at university was the first year I hadn't done any history for a long, long time, and I really missed doing history. So I wouldn't say it was simply a turn away from the sciences, it was a conscious choice to move into history. But until I had that experience of not doing any history, I didn't realise that, you know, I needed it.
And so what made you decide to keep studying history after you did your undergraduate?
I became really interested in what I was doing. It seemed to be a natural step to do a master's, and then after the master's it seemed a natural step to go on to do a PhD. I'm not sure what I would have done if I had decided to leave academia for the, scare quotes, real world, but I would have had some options, I'm sure. But I wasn't forced to explore them because I was successful in going on to do further research.
So why do you think the study of history is important?
I believe that the study of history is really the study of the human condition. And one dimension of the study of the human condition, there are many ways of studying that. And I do believe that there are lessons to be learnt from the study of the past, but not perhaps in the rather trite way that people often say on their applications to university, that, you know, we're doomed to repeat the failures of the past unless we learn the lessons. The past is a pretty complex place, as complex as the present. So the lessons that one can draw, I think, often come from that experience of studying how people behave in a whole range of different situations, and the range of options that people have. So in that sense, I think by studying people in the past, one gets a stronger sense of how people react, think, behave in groups and as individuals, and I think that can help to inform the way one lives one's life today, if one wants to do that.
No, I just think that's again. I think often when we study the past, we realise, one, how complex things are. I think it was well, you know, how little we can really know about the past. And as you say, it reminds us that the present's just as difficult.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there are lots of cases where people want to draw very simple lessons from the past. And sometimes then the job of the historian is to say, well, hang on a minute. I think there are lessons that one can draw, but perhaps they're not necessarily this sort of very clear-cut, this is how we should act in this situation kind of lesson. And there is some danger of fighting the last war when one draws those kinds of lessons from the past.
So what got you into 16th century astronomy and cosmology instead of something like World War II or Henry VIII?
Yeah, I mean, being a historian of science, being trained as a historian of science, shaped the kinds of things that I could study as an undergraduate and therefore found interesting. I wrote an undergraduate dissertation on John Dee.
Interesting fellow.
Elizabethan polymath, Margus, according to some opinions, spy, according to others, or maybe the same opinions, a dupe of a charlatan called Edward Kelly. And having done that, I came to the conclusion that John Dee was the Kevin Bacon of the 16th century. Dee's connections were so widespread to everyone who was interesting in Renaissance scholarly culture, so it seemed to me at the time. And so I became interested then in studying scholarly communities. And I ended up pursuing that interest through study of the astronomical community of the later 16th century, primarily because of two reasons, related reasons. The availability of the source material, on the one hand, and the availability of supervisor expertise on the other. So I was fortunate being able to work with Nick Jardine, in particular, who had for some years been working on a project studying quarrels between astronomers, particularly Kepler and someone called Ursus, who was also an antagonist of Tycho Brahe's. And so it seemed to make sense to start with the available material, particularly the published correspondence of Tycho Brahe. And I had a rather ambitious plan to study other people's correspondence as well that didn't actually get me very far because I ended up writing a PhD without looking at Galileo's correspondence, for example, or much of Kepler's, or Christoph Clavius's The Jesuits. So, those two things. More than a particular background in astronomy, per se, although I think it is one of the very interesting sciences, and certainly it was a very one that was undergoing rapid development in the period, which happens to make it interesting.
So it was a combination of pragmatic and what was it? I think a lot of the times that's the case with PhD research, is that is what your supervisor is able to supervise you on, and also what's available.
Yes, I mean, it was an interesting experience because I first of all told Nick that I wanted to work on communication, and that he was worried initially that I was wanting to go away and write Adrian Jones's PhD thesis, which had been finished and was in the process of being published at the time. But after sort of 24 hours of thought, he realised that the stuff that he himself worked on actually contained lots of interesting material to explore from this angle. So it was at his suggestion that I turned to this astronomical material. And I don't regret that. And in fact, I work with Nick as a sort of collaborator now, so we're on a slightly more equal footing, if one can say that about Nick Jardine.
What was it that you found interesting about astronomical communities, like that made them more distinctive? Because there's a lot of communities, the Republic of Letters at the period.
Mm.
So what made the community around John Dee and Johann Kepler? And
They're not necessarily any more interesting or less interesting, and one can see these people as a subset of the Republic of Letters, and one could actually explore many of the same network or networks, because they tend to overlap, with reference to a different subject matter. So antiquarianism, for example, would be one. I do find that interesting. Much of my ongoing work is exploring things at the intersection of what we take to be disciplines in the period. So I'm increasingly interested in history and the study of the past and how that relates to study of the heavens in the period, or study of place. So in my work on cosmography, I'm interested in the intersection of what we would tend to label as astronomy and geography and a whole set of other disciplines or branches of knowledge, then sort of creep into that astrology, theology, and so on, medicine. So that's interesting to me.
That's certainly very interesting, because I think it's very easy for us to think that disciplines were very clearly demarcated, because they are now.
Yes.
Whereas the distinction between astronomy and astrology isn't really there.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And to some extent, I'm interested in the emergence of disciplines. I mean, there's a lot of talk, sometimes not very reflective talk, about the importance of interdisciplinarity, which always slightly perplexes me, because I don't quite know what it is to be between disciplines. But I think that the emergence of disciplines and the evolution of disciplines and the way in which disciplines change is very interesting and very important to know where we as scholars come from. I do think that working within a discipline is important. I do think that disciplines benefit from conversations, or practitioners of disciplines benefit from conversations with practitioners of other disciplines, but often what you see happening is a kind of absorption of useful knowledge from outside disciplines. So you can think, for example, of the way in which anthropology has informed history through cultural history. And these days there are many, many people out there who would claim to be cultural historians who don't go off and read any anthropology, because they've grown up within the discipline of history, where cultural history is now a sort of accepted form of that discipline. So that's an example of the way in which I think the discipline has changed by contact with scholarship and practitioners from outside the discipline. But it's not still, it's within the discipline of history very clearly.
So with this idea of kind of like this discipline's kind of absorbing different ideas, when you were studying, what were some of the other scholars, obviously Nick Jardine influenced you, but who else did you see kind of as an influence on how you were able to study?
Well, I obviously owe a great debt to Nick as one of my PhD supervisors. The other, Lieber Taub, historian of ancient astronomy by training, who introduced me when I was working on my undergraduate dissertation on John Dee to the study of material culture. That's also very important. Apart from those two, I think, well, a scholar that I tremendously admire and I had the chance to work with during my PhD is Anthony Grafton in Princeton. He is an example of a polymathic scholar whose writings cross a number of disciplinary boundaries, in the sense that he's a historian of scholarship, he's written on the history of astronomy, he's written on humanism, he's tackled topics that might be seen as art history. And I suppose I admire both his scholarship and his generosity with his time. He's someone who's very considerate of, mindful of, the next generation of scholars and willing to assist them. He's also very witty. I like his jokes, some of which appear in print. So I think a sense of humour is also very important for an academic.
And it's something that seems to be quite a lot of absence of in the history of science, from my experience anyway.
Oh, really? Well, yes. I think the writing in the history of science can be quite dry. Sometimes, particularly when it's concerned with the technical side of the sciences. But most historians of science that I know have a wicked sense of humour. So if it doesn't come through in their writing, then normally it comes through in their talks and lectures.
Yes. You mentioned one of your supervisors was interested in material culture, because that's something else you're interested in as well, isn't it?
Yes.
Is the intersection between text, object, and instruments. Maybe you could just briefly say how you think there is that, what relationship is there between them?
Well, I think it's very important when you're exploring a particular topic to try to handle all forms of available evidence. For many topics in the history of astronomy, that's going to include visual material, that's going to include, of course, textual material, and often it's going to include objects. I'm particularly interested, though not simply with the use of those different types of evidence for exploring astronomy in the 16th and 17th centuries, but actually with a particular class of objects that, for example, are texts about the construction and use of astronomical instruments, or are visual representations of instruments. So the kinds of images and texts that concern objects, or even there are examples of books that are themselves instruments that have moving paper parts. So I'm interested in those kind of where the distinction between a text and an instrument breaks down,
mm-hmm.
Or an image and instrument breaks down. And one of the reasons I'm interested in this class of objects is because I don't know that we really have a very good sense of how people actually engaged with books describing the construction and use of instruments. Did people read them with a view to constructing and using instruments?
Mm-hmm.
Did they actually use them for that purpose, or did they serve some other purpose? And I suspect that we'll find, if we do find evidence that has some bearing on that, that people use these things for a variety of reasons and in a variety of ways. But I think that the whole class of objects is something that needs to be further explored.
So I suppose like the books are about objects. So I suppose in some ways they could be like DRI manuals today. Everyone has them. Not everybody uses them.
Well, exactly. Yes. Yeah. You know, instructions. I mean, who actually uses the instructions? I mean, one of course, the important ideas in the history of science is the idea of tacit knowledge. The
mm-hmm.
idea that perhaps when you're constructing an instrument, or you're trying to give someone else instructions on how to construct an instrument, it's very difficult to be explicit in a way that will capture everything that will allow someone else to construct the same object,
mm.
because you have possessed knowledge yourself about how to build it and how it actually works that you don't necessarily realise you possess, or you don't realise is crucial to the success of this artefact. And so there might be a kind of presupposition that actually for at least some of the more complicated devices, textual and even visual information
mm-hmm.
is going to be insufficient. So to what extent then could one build an instrument using
mm-hmm.
these kinds of sources? Did one actually need personal instruction? Did one need personal instruction to actually use an instrument, or could one follow a set of instructions? So those are, I think, some of the interesting questions relating to this material.
So especially with astronomical instruments, some of the craftsmership of the kind of the gauges is very specific, and that's not going to be. That's something that only a craftsman can really gain through.
Yes,
experience.
I mean, I think, I mean, that's why the sort of the intersecting objects that are print objects. That could also, in theory, function as instruments are a particularly interesting case, because it's possible to print flat instruments and then, in theory, at least one could assemble those so that they move and then
mm-hmm.
one could use them. We know of some cases of such instruments that appear to have been constructed and assembled and used according to the instructions. But I mean, it's also the case that when we see an instrument trade beginning, again, we have quite a lot of evidence for class of instrument that don't survive. It tends to be the more elaborate, more precious, valuable objects that do survive. Possibly they're rather unrepresentative of the whole class of objects of that type, which might well have been made from paper pasted onto wood. So that does raise questions about the ubiquity, perhaps, of these kinds of instruments, and therefore questions about how widespread knowledge of how to use them would be. if you need a tutor, how easy would it be to find someone who could tutor in the use of these instruments? And I still don't think we have a very good sense of that.
I can imagine that's one of the challenges, I guess, is some of these things, questions, it's very difficult to get answers to. Given that you've mentioned a huge wealth of sources, how do you approach, do you have different methodologies and ways you approach an instrument, say, instead of a visual source or a text? How do you juggle, I guess, all the different...
I don't know that I see them as particularly different types of artifact. And to some extent, that's because, as part of my work, I'm studying a historian of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that historians of the book have increasingly learned to do, I think, is to see books as material objects. And so to take them to be evidence and explore them and analyse them in ways that go over and above the text they carry.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, one of the things that historians of instruments do, and perhaps have increasingly done in recent years, is acknowledge that instruments are carriers of text. Mm-hmm. So you have to interpret the text, the scales, the divisions... but often accompanying text about ownership and so on, text reflecting use. So you have to interpret the text as well as the object. And you have to, I think, acknowledge with instruments, as you do with textual sources, that the intended purpose, the intended meaning of a text or an object underdetermines the use that's actually made of it. Right. People can use instruments in ways that are at odds with the maker's or manufacturer's intentions. People frequently make use of texts in ways that are at odds with the intentions of the author or the book producer. And so I actually tend to approach, I think, these different types of sources in a more similar fashion than see them as things that need very different tools to analyse.
I think that's fascinating. I think that's a very good way of approaching this. And I think the more we approach things in a similar way, I think the more you realise that there's a greater kinship between them, even though disciplines often like to kind of hold them to themselves and say, no, this is just an image. You can't read it as a text.
Yes, I mean, I do think there's a strong case for... I mean, this is one sort of complicating factor for the kind of work I do, that... the ordinary language usage of words like text and image and inscription becomes really very important. Because if you start to use language like text or inscription to refer to things other than a textual source, other than something that's actually engraved, as many of my objects are, then you begin to sort of tie yourself up in linguistic knots. So some of the insights that other kinds of scholars have acquired and communicated about, for example, seeing every kind of source as a text in some sense, they're very useful. But the way in which those insights are expressed is sometimes actually unhelpful to keeping a grip on the different kinds of source that you're actually dealing with.
I think that's a very good point that I think we should all be aware of. I guess finally, what advice would you give someone who kind of a budding historian now, like in terms of kind of how what should they be looking at, or what do you think? I guess what interesting ways do you think the profession is moving and.
Gosh, I think it's getting harder than it used to become a historian. And one of the reasons for that is that it's very important if you are going to survive your PhD that you are studying something that you care about. But of course, increasingly, funding, what funding there is not being made available to bright young people to pursue whatever it is they're interested in, but is being made available to particular projects focused on particular things. So you need a good match between the project that you might be attached to and your own interests. I have, I suppose, one piece of advice about, if you do have the opportunity to find a topic, about the way to go about that. This is a piece of advice I always give to my own undergraduates, and they normally ignore it. So I feel frustrated about this, so I'm going to convey it to as many people as I can. And that is that, of course, one way to go about your business as a historian is to think up a topic and then to go away and look to see what sources, what evidence might be available for that. I think another very good way of doing it, particularly for something like an undergraduate or a master's dissertation, is to find one really good source. Doesn't matter whether it's a text or an image or an object. Find one really good source and work outwards from it. And there are lots of things normally that you can find to say about that source. And you may find that your project expands a long way beyond that first source. But if you can find one thing that interests you, then that's a good starting point. And I would say that curiosity and surprise are really important. So if you find something surprising as a historian, then it's worth finding out why.
Mm-hmm.
Because that can often be the source of a good project. And if I may allow to say one more thing.
Say one more thing.
The one more other thing I would say is that it's very easy to be guided by what historians have already done, and almost impossible not to be.
Mm-hmm.
But the most interesting projects are the one that perhaps start at the periphery of what has already been done, and then find new questions to tackle. I know that sounds it's quite clear how one does that, mm-hmm. But I do think that, for example, in the history of astronomy, my own topic, a lot of work has been done on Galileo. We may not need much more work on Galileo in the near future. I think we probably have enough to be getting on with.
Like
World War II. So there are certain topics where perhaps people get interested in them as undergraduates, and it seems natural to work on them as mm-hmm. as postgraduates, and then one can end up writing a book on them. But some of those topics and some of those books, perhaps we don't need.
I think both things are very important, because I think if you go with a project in mind and look for sources, you end up looking through a filter and kind of imposing what you want on the sources. And so the other way is very good. I think the same thing about there's always that tendency to focus on the canonical figures of the past, and in doing so, we can almost forget that Galileo wasn't famous. Well, he was famous, but not as famous. And so, looking at the periphery figures kind of helps to kind of reconstruct, maybe, and pose interesting questions.
And we don't really. If there are senses in which we don't fully understand Galileo, and I suspect there are. There's senses which arise from the fact that we don't fully understand Galileo's context.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to learn more, I think, about Galileo by not studying Galileo than we are by studying him again in the same way that people have already done. And I'm certainly struck by that with some of the people that I've looked at and worked on in relation to a figure like Tycho Brahe, where... yes, it's the fascinating figures about whom we need to know more are the people who seem to be the next rank below mm-hmm. the big names or below that, but they're essential to understand the context. And if you want to understand not simply the kind of history of progress to the modern day, again, mm-hmm. I'll use scare quotes around progress, mm-hmm. But you want to understand... what people in their own time thought they were doing, then I think you really need to look at some of the other figures that the big names.
Thank you so much for your time, Adam.
You're welcome.
And it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you.